Yeah. Good morning, everybody. And also, thank you for having me here. I'm very happy that I can join this symposium. And actually, I want to say that I'm coming from Germany, and I've been working a couple of years in Moscow as an architect. And I came to the subject of the avant-garde already from my school day time, and my main concern in these things is the materials and construction technologies, because I'm a very practical person, so I don't want to disappoint you, but this lecture is divided into two parts, and the first part is the construction materials, and then I come to the planetarium, but it's the smaller part. So we've heard about this yesterday already, and it is because the specific situation within the economies and societies of Europe after World War I, as well as in the Soviet Union after years of civil war, forced a rational approach in construction activities. And in Europe, this was to cause a revolution in building traditions that had not changed that since the Middle Ages. Architects and engineers combined their aesthetics with the technical requirements of quick, easy, and cheap production processes. And for the first time, up from them, buildings were the result of the mechanisms of their production process and erected with great precision. And from today's point of view, this revolution became the basis of our contemporary construction technology with its huge variety of materials and methods. And this is one reason why the avant-garde is so important for our cultural memory and why, for example, we have seen that the Bauhaus sites in Dessau and Weimar were listed as World Heritage. And I always saw this very, very narrow joint between Germany and Russia. And when I started in Russia to deal with this problem, the main excuse was that the building materials are much worse than our building materials of that time. And I always doubted this and tried to find out and prove that this is not the case, and actually it isn't. The fight for rational approaches in production and new construction methods became the focus of practical work of the German Bauhaus. The construction of the workers' settlement in Dessau-Terten, which was designed by Gropius and the Bauhaus office, illustrates this work quite well. For the first time in history, all the materials such as furnace clinker bricks and concrete beams were produced on site. The German government supported these efforts by founding a state research society named RFG, die Reichsforschungsgesellschaft für Wirtschaftlichkeit im Bau- und Wohnungswesen. We always like very long names, so I call it the RFG, became the financing and partner organization for many architectural projects such as the workers' settlements in Berlin, Frankfurt, Dessau, and the Weißenhof settlement in Stuttgart, where a lot of different innovative construction methods were carried out. So you can see it here above. This is the construction process of Dessau-Terten, where they produced these slag blocks on site, and it was actually the same in Moscow for the Nakhomfin house. Similar experiments were executed in the Soviet Union. Quite a number of scientific institutes had been founded in order to improve the quality of rational construction materials as well as to establish new construction methods. Since 1923, the so-called settlement near Moscow was erected to experience especially new sandwich construction methods for the external wall with new insulation materials such as peat board or slag, as a cheap leftover of industrial processes. So all these materials I'm talking now, they are so typical for the modern movement. And this was something totally new, dealing with artificial materials, not just brick, wood, and steel or glass. A couple of scientific institutes were founded And in order to verify their laboratory tests of construction materials, the so-called experimental buildings were erected. And again, I'm sorry, it's always the Narkomfin building, for example. These buildings were given privileged status, and this is something I consider very important, because exactly these buildings out of the experimental programs, they were all erected between 27 and 29. They are on total analogy with the main icons of the modern movement all over Europe. This is something one has to divide a little bit. I come back to this later. So the Soviet government has set up the state program to rationalize housing production. And since 1928, Moshe Ginzburg was the leader of this housing program, and his architects designed the famous housing types such as the type F, which you can find in the Narkomfin house. And this, I don't need to explain a lot about the Narkomfin house now, but it was one of these pilot projects of the state program, and it was erected on total one-to-one analogy with this workers' settlement in Dessau. It was the first attempt in Moscow to prefabricate materials on site. Another famous example of this experimental program is Konstantin Melnikov's own house and student. It was also part of the experimental program. Focusing on saving time, material, and therefore money, Melnikov's house is probably the best illustration of the architect's experiments in dissolving the load-bearing external wall. So this was all approaches how to make construction cheaper, and the easiest way to reduce the weight within the structure was to leave a cavity as a barrier for humidity as well as an insulating layer. The unique structure of the Melnikov house was an attempt to include a maximum space with a minimum number of bricks, which was a very clever idea, because the brick only followed the load-bearing lines. The honeycomb windows allowed to save on window beams, and these walls were named after the engineer Anton Gerhard as a Gerhard wall. I need to go back. So the master houses in Dessau, designed by Walter Gropius, and the Bauhaus office also have such cavity walls made of lightweight cinder concrete boards named Yoko, filled with peat board. Peat is a very important material of this time. This system was also used in Dessau-Terten, and I can refer to the planetarium because the annex buildings of the planetarium in Moscow, which were damaged during the last reconstruction, they also had these brick walls with a cavity filled with pressed peat. Mostly this cavity was filled with peat, slag, with coal dust, with chips of wood, straw, or even construction rubbish. These materials became the standard of the time. Insulating a building with warm, mostly organic materials is also an innovation that came with the modern movement. These materials were called sphagnum in the Soviet Union or torfoleum in Germany. It allowed the reduction of the thickness of the traditional brick walls. So pressed wood wall boards like Heraklit, produced in Austria since 1908, they were the first ones to appear. In the 1920s, for the first time, lightweight insulation boards were fabricated in the same way as pressing organic materials such as sugar cane fibers, wood chips, wood wall, animal hairs into boards, and then adding cement to consolidate them. In 1928, the Moscow Construction Institute researched the mixture of this Heraklit boards and then develop fibrolite, pressed cement boards out of wood wall. This is in principle the same. It just has another name. In Russia, these materials are known as torfoplite, solomite with straw, insurite, kamishit, or different. I don't bother you with all these names, but it's the same way of pressing these organic materials. Another important one is wood cement, which is typical for the modern movement. For acoustic and thermal insulation purposes, very small pieces of wood were mixed into the screed to make it warmer as well as to provide more soundproofing. This thin floor finish you can still find in the house on Gogolevsky Boulevard in Moscow, another commune house, and also in the Bauhaus. So also typical, we have heard from Jean-Louis yesterday, were the concrete or steel skeletons of that time. They developed in tandem within the development of concrete as a common construction material. Load-bearing concrete columns as a grid allowed the external wall to be constructed only as a shelter from weather with freely positioned window openings. The whole variety of new artificially made materials such as lightweight concrete stones with pumice or tuff or hollow blocks or boards were utilized. In Russia, even only two layers of fibrillite boards were used to construct the external wall, and I mention this on purpose because this is, of course, something very, very curious to do this, because this is just pressed straw as an external wall, and this is what happened in some of these workers' settlements or houses were not the pilot projects. And that's where also the criticism on constructivism comes from, because this is what people experience in their life, living in such a house, for example, and trying to put up a kitchen board on an external wall out of straw. So concrete, of course, was very important, and one started to make external walls also of in-situ concrete. The so-called Kossel slag concrete, named after the constructor Paul Kossel from Bremen, Germany, became very famous. With his assistance, a German-Russian construction trust, Russgerstroy, built the House of the Red Professors on Piragovskaya Street in Moscow. This concrete typically was without reinforcement. Only the window beams and the ends of the floor slabs were reinforced. The same Kossel slag concrete was used with different mixtures on the houses of Johannes Peter Uth in the Weißenhof settlement, which you see there. And when the restoration was made, the first one in the 80s, there was the same problem. They found concrete, like you can see on the left side on the Piragovskaya Street. It's not better. It's not. And there were different companies also in the Bauhaus. They found like six different companies were working on that, and they had so many different mixtures. I just try to illustrate that what we have today in Russia, it's the same fabric as what in other European countries you can find. And also, of course, very important was concrete, which tried in order to improve waterproofing qualities, which was used very much to erect the cupolas of the various planetariums that have been built in the 1920s. This one is the one of Berlin, and the Moscow one is the same. The construction of flat roofs and roof gardens was one of the challenges of the avant-garde architects, and many different methods of constructing these flat roofs were realized. The so-called flat roof discussion of the time was as controversial in Russia as it was all over Europe. And I show you some examples here. For example, like Melnikov used to do, also the Frankfurt settlements with the flat roofs were constructed and covered with metal sheets on shuttering above wooden beams as well as on in-situ concrete slabs. From today's point of view, they are all prototypes of what we call now warm roofs. And typically the insulation layer, as it is slag, cork, or torfoleum, was covered with a slightly sloped concrete screed. In Germany, mostly roof fells, ruberoid and bitumen were used for waterproofing those flat roofs, whereas in Russia, wood cement proofing was the most popular construction. It consisted of several layers of bituminous asphalt paste. Another famous pioneer of the avant-garde is the Russian architect or engineer Alexander Kuznetsov, who must be honored today as Russia's pioneer in the construction of cold or ventilated roofs. In his roofs in the Electrotechnical Institute in Moscow, he already separated the waterproofing and insulation layer. By using ventilation, he tried to avoid internal damages. The parapet hit the interior flat slope roof, which is a typical solution to introduce the flat roof despite Russia's climatic conditions. So these principles, in fact, most of today's construction principles of flat roofs are still based on these pioneer inventions of the 1920s. And of course, there were a lot of damages of these first flat roofs, which was quite natural, as any new construction method has to undergo a process of optimizing before being perfected. But for the little knowledge and building physics at the time, most of the different constructions for creating a flat roof were quite intelligent. I have to hurry up. In both countries, floor slabs were traditionally made from wood, and with regard to housing, this remained the usual constructions, but at the same time, a huge number of innovative systems entered the construction market, including all these new insulation materials, peat, slag, fibrolite. In Germany, reinforced stone slabs were used since the end of the 19th century, and they became actually quite typical for the modern movement, whereas for cost reasons, they were not used in Russia, and the Nakhonfin house is probably the only one from the 1920s which has slabs made of furnace clinker concrete blocks covered with 5 centimeters in situ concrete. This is just to show you one of the big number of prefabricated concrete systems, the caisson systems, which was used for the Pravda print shop we have seen yesterday. So another important subject is the windows, because in both countries, wooden windows were traditional with all sorts of different opening mechanisms, which were further developed through the modern movement. In Russia, the combination of 2 single-glazed wooden windows at about 20 centimeters distance with a single wooden window frame became quite typical. You can find sliding windows or joint windows as a first step for better thermal insulation. All these things which are so normal today in construction, it all comes from the 1920s. The avant-garde architects, of course, preferred metal window frames, which were not yet thermally separated and caused sometimes a lot of damages due to condensation. But because of the lack of metal, they imitated metal frames by using very thin wooden profiles for framing. However, some of these pilot projects still had metal frame windows, such as the Zuyev Workers' Club on top, with his famous cylindric glazed in staircase, or the Moscow Planetarium head. They are gone now. The frames were manufactured out of very simple T or L profiles, but looked very elegant. Glazing the big openings was usually made as 2 independent layers of glazing. This is called in Russia winter glazing. Today we know that the winter glazing, for example, in Le Corbusier's Centre Soyuz, is already the prototype for today's sophisticated climate facades. And this is just to show one example of the sliding windows, which also became a typical feature for the 1920s, and the strong parallelity between the Nakhonfin house and Le Corbusier's house in the Weissenhof exhibition in Stuttgart were quite similar. Le Corbusier used a prototype for an insulating glass unit, whereas Ginzburg put his window into 2 single layers, which was normal practice in Russia. But these both, they copied a lot from each other, I think, or discussed a lot. This is just to show the experiments. They made even experiments with using concrete as window frames, which you can really also find in the Nakhonfin house and in Dessau-Törten, but these experiments actually failed totally and were never further investigated, and this is, of course, some of these problems which we would have to face if restoring these buildings, because it's not so easy. So, and this is from my daily work, what I do at the moment. All the examples I've shown to you show the revolutionary innovations with regard to construction methods and materials as a parallel development in Europe and in the Russian avant-garde. And this refers especially to the pilot projects erected between 27 and 29. However, investigations of more than 350 constructivist buildings from the period of 24 to 32, mainly located in Moscow, while establishing a database, revealed as a preliminary result that the detailed design of many constructivist buildings, at least in Moscow, is a bit more rough in comparison with the most preserved modern movement sites, at least in Germany. With regard to the lack of materials in the Soviet construction market at the time, certainly more detailed design changes had to be made than in other European countries during the construction process. But this does not automatically mean that the chosen substitute materials, for example wood instead of metal-framed windows, were inferior in durability, because a lot of these buildings have wooden window frames, and from today's point of view, this is much easier to preserve than the metal frames which we have in Germany with most of these buildings and which cause a lot of damages. I probably can skip this one because we have had that before, and it's just to show that actually the way the destiny of the avant-garde buildings and ours, in mostly located in eastern Germany, it only separated in 91, when up to that time they were all treated the same. The Nazis didn't like the modern movement and they did everything to get rid of this modern appearance, and it ended with the deferred maintenance of during the GDR until 1990. But today, the base for scientific restorations, the material substance of the Bauhaus buildings in East Germany, it is the same as today's untouched, still existing constructivist buildings in Russia. So, and now I come to part two. Another. Talking about the planetarium in Moscow. This problem of constructing cupolas is probably one of the oldest subjects in construction history in order to enclose large spaces. It started with the Pantheon in Rome that was followed by quite a number of famous cupolas like the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople that time, St. Peter in Rome, and the diameter of the Roman Pantheon was only superseded in 1913 by the Centennial Hall in Wroclaw or Breslau with 65 meters span. An important step in the further development were the stressed skin constructions. So only when the construction technology of concrete was further developed, one architect succeeded in spanning much more diameter than the Pantheon had. The understanding that rotation cupolas are able to carry loads not only in the direction of the cupola itself, but also perpendicular, together with the invention of this torquete shotcrete concrete, became the base of the patented size planetarium constructions of the 1920s. And the predecessor of Moscow's planetarium was the Jena Planetarium in Germany with a 25-meter span and 400 seats. In Jena, the cupola is based on a concrete ring carried by 20 concrete columns. The structure of the cupola consists of 7,992 pieces of long steel beams connected with turnbuckles and then shotcreted with concrete up to 6 centimeters. The concrete membrane received a 5 centimeters peatboard insulation, as we had in Moscow, on the outside, and 2 layers of rubberoid waterproofing, also very typical material of that time. The entrance area and all other rooms are located in the little vestibule, which you can see on the lower one. And in order to create good acoustics, a second steel structure was placed inside, carrying convex string metal sheets. Both were covered with white cotton fabric as a projection screen. This Jena Planetarium, it is still in place and it still functions. It still looks like that. And if you go on the internet, you can just book a ticket and go there. So, and the idea to build such a structure in Moscow occurred in 1926. Since then, the architects Michael Bartsch and Michael Sinyavsky and the architect Sundblad worked on the realization of the project. The Moscow Planetarium consisted of all the typical modern movement materials. The planetarium is a reinforced concrete skeleton construction. It was and partly still is enclosed with a clamshell masonry work of this Gerhard system with a cavity I showed in the beginning. The cupola measures 27 meters in diameter without ribs, and it's made of reinforced shotcrete concrete based on a concrete ring on radial concrete frames. It's 12 centimeters thick on the bottom and 8 centimeters on the top, and it was insulated with sphagnum peat moss. A spherical projection screen was fixed to a metal net. This inside cupola had a span screen showing Moscow's silhouette designed by the Sternberg brothers, also famous avant-garde painters. In 2002, the planetarium still housed the original demonstration apparatus you have seen before, as in Jena, and the building with its cupola could be read as a pure case construction, a demonstration of its interior function. It was as sophisticated at the time as the machine for projecting the stars onto the interior screen itself. And therefore, in 1987, the planetarium was listed as a monument. However, in Moscow, people were unhappy with the floor layout and the daily operation of their planetarium from the very beginning. First changes happened quickly, and I quote Mr. Anisimov, who made the recent restoration project. He said, a film projection room was added, and the main staircase was fitted with subsidiary spaces on the second and third floor. Attempts were made to use the low bases for storage, a cafeteria, and library, and still the building was short on toilets, had no proper cafeteria, cloakroom, and ventilation. There were also serious problems with temperature control and the walls that froze through. And due to lack of maintenance over decades, in 1996, the planetarium was in a dilapidated condition and really urgently required restoration. But the main problem with all these buildings is indeed lack of maintenance. No house can be kept up without maintenance, and this is also one main problem in Russia. So they made a reconstruction project, the office of Anisimov. And the main aim of this reconstruction project was to open up the planetarium silhouette to the city and to return the building to its original appearance by eliminating all later additions. They wanted to develop the planetarium's principal function and to turn it into a modern cultural center and to allow parts of the city, parts of the building to be used for commercial purposes, to provide modern levels of comfort to the visitors and to replace the existing equipment with modern technology and to install the underground space beneath the building. So we have seen that yesterday already, Natalia illustrated it. An immense amount of space was added at that time. And what they did, since in 2004 the cupola was hydraulically raised by 6.30 meters, the new space was used to build an underground garage to enlarge the foyer and to open the museum area. The original annexes on the side, such as the steel spiral staircase, were removed and replaced with reconstructions. All this you see here on the left top, it's all new. The interior built-in elements and large sections of plaster were removed, and the concrete cupola was given a new roof construction on top of a new wooden shuttering. And the previously renewed exterior railing of the cupola, as well as the windows and doors, were replaced. And also, unfortunately, the preserved original size machine was replaced. As a result of the recent reconstruction works, the historic Moscow Planetarium has gone forever. The concrete cupola and parts of the carcass and external wall are the only elements that are still authentic today. It was cut off its historic roots. And for me, this is just an act of disrespect, as Russia tends to disrespect people also. I'm sorry, but it's to cut off a building and to lift it up is just something which to me is inhuman and in. You can't do that with monuments. In other words, it was altered to death to fit everybody's requirements except the monument's requirements. This is a pure investment project without preserving the authentic historic atmosphere of the 1920s due to the mass replacement of historic fabric. This reconstruction or rebuilt monument as a more or less replica, it has nothing to do with the international adopted guidelines for restorations as they were established in the Venice Charter of 64, because complete reconstruction is by no means a name of restorations in the sense of the Venice Charter. The Charter of Venice had been ignored in almost its articles, especially with regard to the articles concerning restoration guidelines. Therefore, the opportunity to include the Moscow Planetarium into the World Heritage List is irreversibly gone. And with regard to our last year's Moscow Declaration, where it says, and I quote, considering the adhesion of the Russian Federation to the 1972 World Heritage Convention, and as such, it aims for the highest standards of excellence to be applied in the identification, conservation, protection, and management of cultural sites and heritage in Russia, particularly but not exclusively those inscribed in the World Heritage List, and recognizing the outstanding contribution of the Russian avant-garde movement in the history of architecture worldwide and the urgency of preserving this heritage, I finish, for the benefit of current and future generations international. And with regard to this quoted aims of the planetarium project, I must assume that in this project, in this case, a restoration in the sense of Venice Carter was never envisioned. In fact, the public and the restoration team are very proud of the result because all the main restoration aims had been achieved. However, in an international context, the result is quite tragic because the Moscow Planetarium was an outstanding avant-garde monument, easily to be included into the World Heritage as the pure, authentic, sized duviduck, parabolic, reinforced concrete cupola with an original preserved projector on Earth. And why to lift it up? I would have asked why not just leave it, and in the worst case, just unused. It sounds like a very luxury idea, but it would have brought a great benefit from cultural point of view, and unfortunately, this cultural benefit can only be measured by continuing history. One could have carefully restored it and left it for the next generations, just as a technical monument, like an example, we have this wind channel from 34 in Berlin Adlershof. This 20-meter high concrete structure with a span of 12 meters was constructed for testing aircraft reactions in the air. You have this in Moscow in the Tsagi Institute. You have the same features, the same apparatus. This wind channel today symbolizes the optimistic faith of the 20th century in the technological future and nothing more. It's open to the public. You can go there and visit it like a museum. So what happened to the Moscow Planetarium should not happen again to any other still authentically preserved avant-garde site, and this is my biggest wish for the future of the Russian avant-garde in order to implement at least the outstanding icons of this great early 20th century architecture into the World Heritage List. Thank you.